This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When a man or woman leaves the military, they can expect to get a helping hand with college tuition. But there's an effort now from schools and communities to help veterans get a head start in business.
Communities are really investing in these programs to make sure that the next generation of entrepreneurs are supported.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll learn about one of those programs. We'll also tour a facility that helps train Veterans Administration doctors, hear about college students' newfound stress, and spend an academic minute urging older adults to volunteer. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Around the country, state governments and other agencies are trying to promote entrepreneurship among military veterans. Former service members are more likely to go into business for themselves compared with their civilian counterparts. From Tampa, Florida, Bobby O'Brien reports.
These are all green Malayan right here we're looking at.
Justin Duay is walking through his coconut groves in Homestead, Florida. The 28-year-old Army linguist and cyber specialist is transitioning into civilian life. That's why he bought the 5-acre Coco Rico Farms, sight unseen.
I farmed before in Texas, but it was all vegetable farming, nothing like this. But I saw the potential of money that, you know, they were growing fruit and that they, you know, that it was a good investment.
That was less than a year ago. Duay admits he knew nothing about coconuts at the time. But just like when he learned Farsi in 47 weeks in the Army, Duay sees the challenge. And his military experience is helping him in other ways. He happened to cross paths with a veteran in the food business who was looking for a fresh coconut supplier. As two Army men, they bonded instantly.
And that's part of the military mindset. You see each other and you pick up your battle buddy and they pick you up and you both have a vision, a goal, and you keep on moving forward.
So Duay and Alex Hill became business battle buddies, not partners, but supplier and vendor. Hill, who was in the Army Airborne, sells fresh coconut water to tourists along the beach. He says it's not the first time he's done business with other people who've been in the military.
You know, they have a similar work ethic as you, you know, and they also uphold those similar values that you have. It's hard to find people that have those same values that are outside the military.
About 2.5 million veterans own businesses. According to the Syracuse University Institute for Veterans and Military Families, veterans own 13% to 15% of small businesses, though they're only 8% of the population. And the Institute's Misty Stutzman says female veterans in particular are driving the trend.
Women veteran entrepreneurship has grown over 300% since 2007. Which is insane. But I think that, you know, as you look at these entrepreneurs, not only is the startups great, but they're out earning their civilian counterparts.
That success record among veteran-owned startups has attracted the attention of states, universities, and other agencies. They've launched hundreds of programs around the country in the past few years designed to help veterans get their businesses off the ground.
The biggest thing that shows the growth of entrepreneurship and the growth of small business and how important it is the fact that communities are really investing in these programs to make sure that the next generation of entrepreneurs are supported.
Welcome to the Veterans Florida Battle of the Pitches.
This is one popular feature of many entrepreneurship programs. Welcome to the state of Florida's first ever Battle of the Pitches, where veteran entrepreneurs competed for more than $20,000 in cash from the state government.
Second place goes to Alex Hill of Florida Coconuts.
Alex Hill's company, Florida Coconuts, took second prize. He lost out to a National Guardsman with a specialized motor company. But Hill's prize came at a good time. A drop in the coconut supply and a seasonal dip in tourism has hurt his business. So he's pursuing a new entrepreneurial idea. Hill is trying to design a coconut opener, better than his Army-issued axe. I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
And let's stay in Central Florida while we're up. For years, veterans have been telling us about problems at VA hospitals around the country. Long waits for appointments and outdated facilities are some of the most common complaints. Then there's the VA Medical Center at Lake Nona, Florida, just outside Orlando. The 1.2 million square foot facility is located on a 65-acre campus and cost $600 million to construct. Located on that campus is a state-of-the-art training center for VA doctors. Dr. Haru Okuda is the National Medical Director for the Department of Veterans Affairs Simulation Learning Education and Research Network, or SimLearn program. I took a tour of that facility and talked to Dr. Okuda about this educational center for doctors.
The National Simulation Center of the VA is a 51,000 square foot immersive training center for healthcare providers. What's unique about this center is that the focus is not on trainees like medical students, nursing students, or residents. The focus is on our existing workforce, our frontline docs, our frontline nurses, and the gap that we're trying to fill is multifold, but many include teamwork, communication skills and training, incorporating and learning new technologies that are being developed by industry, and getting our docs and nurses proficient with those new technologies, and then evaluating some of the newer procedures and technologies that are coming out to help our frontline workforce.
And this is a fairly new facility, isn't it?
Absolutely. This was built. We did our ribbon cutting in September of 2016. We were established or approved to be established in 2009. So it's been a long time coming.
And you're primarily doing VA doctors, right?
That's correct. Our main target audience is focused on training our frontline VA healthcare providers. So doctors are some of them, but nurses, respiratory therapists, mental health, social workers, etc.
You're training doctors who have been in the field some, 10, 20, 30 years. How do they feel on coming in and working on mannequins?
So it varies. I think a lot of the younger generation doctors that are coming out, they may have experienced this in their training, and they expect it when they come out, and they're very excited about it. Some of the more senior doctors that have been out for a while, it varies in their adoption. Some are very excited because they understand how the technology can help them close some of the gaps that they foresee on their own. Others are a little bit more apprehensive and say, well, what is this technology? Is this really patients? I don't really believe in it. But I would say majority, over 99% of the folks that come through here by the end of the training are immersed. They give a lot of positive feedback on their experience. They feel is value added.
And is this doctors from all over the country?
Over 150 healthcare sites across the organization with 20,000 doctors and I think over 90,000 nurses and other healthcare folks is our target audience.
This is a huge facility.
It is very big. It's probably one of the top 10 biggest in the country. But if you think about our target population, I mean, the VHA has over 300,000 staff. If you talk square footage per staff, it's not that big. And I think, if you want to create a true immersive training experience for the different kinds of healthcare teams, from operating room to the ICU to outpatient clinics to mental health to ERs, you need the space to be able to recreate their immersive experience.
And how many are you training?
We're training, I believe, our goal is to train over 2,000 a year as instructors coming through the facility, and then they'll go back, and it'll be an exponential effect because then they're going to start training folks locally as well.
How is a doctor chosen for the training? It's like, okay, this guy from Cincinnati needed to come here and learn this.
So what we do is we reach out to the leadership at each facility and say we're looking for experts in both the content as well as instruction. And in certain topic areas, and then they're identified by their chief of staff or the chief of nursing, and then they're sent over to our facility.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing healthcare modeling simulation since probably about 15 years now. I started out in New York building the simulation program for the New York City Public Health System and came over here about 6 years ago.
Part of the training at the center involves games. Dr. Okuda says this is a new addition to doctor education at the VA.
The VA has a division that focuses developing training on seeing the effectiveness of educational games for our healthcare providers. We actually adopted a lot of the best practices already used from the Department of Defense, who use serious games for training their warfighters. And so what we're trying to do is seeing if we can bridge some of our learning competencies using different types of educational games for both team training skills, some of the knowledge pieces, and we're finding it being very effective. But it's still very new in healthcare, so we're still evaluating it and how to deploy it.
So are we talking video games?
It's a screen-based educational game, yeah.
Is virtual reality not too far off?
We are standing up a virtual reality footprint within our facility, a virtual and augmented reality.
Walking around the facility with about a dozen other journalists from around the country, Dr. Okuda pointed out different simulation areas of the building in a wide variety of specialties.
So this is not as, I mean, it's exciting, but to me, as an ER doc, I like the you know, the blood and all that, the gores and stuff. This is our outpatient clinic area. So, you know, on the left, we have you do general clinic rooms. On the right, we have, like, dental simulators and ophthalmology simulators, et cetera.
Dr. Okuda also talked about the mental health simulation room to help doctors prepare for veterans with PTSD and other mental health conditions.
It's a room it prevents folks from harming themselves. So it has different kind of furniture. I mean, you wonder, you saw the report on the gentleman, the athlete that hung himself in a jail. And you go, well, how do they do that, right? And so I used to work in a level one trauma center in Queens, and we had a lot of inmates from Rikers Island, and we'd have people trying to hang themselves. And what they do is they take their sheets and they hang it to some doorknob or something. Most of the times, it's not somebody from the ceiling. It's like they're trying to hang themselves, like, kind of sideways off of something down low. So these mental health rooms are built so that you don't have the ability. There's nothing in there that you can harm yourself on. And so because mental health is such a big area of focus within the VA, obviously we needed to build in the capabilities to do mental health training. The kind of training that we might do is like de-escalation. So if somebody gets admitted because they're depressed or suicidal or, you know, have some sort of mental health issue and they start getting really agitated or PTSD and aggressive, you know, you want to ideally you de-escalate verbally, right? That's your initial one. And then if you can't do it that way, then you try to give some sedation and other things to calm them down. So we'll have actors or our staff play roles, and we'll have learning objectives. We'll try to keep it as safe as possible. And you know, if they do the right things that they learn for de-escalation techniques, then they'll back off, right? But if they don't meet their objectives, then they'll escalate, just like a patient would.
Rather than looking like a school, the SimLearn Center has the appearance of a typical VA hospital. In fact, if you were to walk through the center, you probably wouldn't be able to tell it was a simulation center until you saw the mannequins on the beds.
So you want to train, in the military they say train as you fight, okay, right? And so you want to train in the environment that's most familiar to you, because, you know, if you have learners coming in and they're in an unfamiliar environment, they're not going to learn. They're going to be trying to figure out the environment. So you want to recreate the environment. And the other big thing with healthcare, and I think with a lot of things, is a lot of the errors or issues are systems issues. You know, knowing how to use a piece of equipment, knowing how the process works, you're laying that on top of all the communication and the medical problems. So we sometimes will integrate some of the room issues or equipment failures as part of the training.
Okay. Is there anything you can't simulate now or would like to simulate better?
So the gushy stuff on the inside. So doing actual surgeries is tricky. I mean, there are some, we haven't done it yet, but there are some facilities that have taken, there aren't simulators that do this off the market yet, but they'll actually, one of our sites out in San Francisco cored out one of their mannequins, and they bought a simulated heart. They threw it in there, and then they were training on something called restrenotomy. So if a person just recently had a cardiac surgery and they go into cardiac arrest, you know, most of the people, the manager, if you go into cardiac arrest, you push on a chest. But in this specific target group, is there a problem with bleeding around the heart? And if there is, you need to decompress it quickly, right? But if you just push on the chest, they're never going to survive if they're bleeding around the heart. So they had to teach them, how do you really quickly open the chest, look at what the issues are, and fix the issue. So there aren't that many simulators that actually have that surgical feel where somebody, that's all done in virtual reality, where, you know, physically you can go in and fix the heart, or physically you can suture the belly, the intestines. I don't know of mannequins that quite do that yet.
So a lot of still being used with cadavers.
A lot of cadaver use, or in some places we don't do it, but live animals, you know, they do some work with that for training and procedures.
Dr. Haru Okuda is the National Medical Director for the Department of Veterans Affairs SimLearn program. You can see pictures of the center and find links to more information on the Best of Our Knowledge page at wamc.org. Still to come, college is a time for learning and growing and discovering the joys of stress. That story's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Sure, succeeding in high school can bring on some stress, but once a student hits college, the levels get turned up. Sophie Cannon reports.
College stress is when teachers assign two projects and give you three exams in a two-day span. Also, on top of that, you have other classes.
The American College Health Association reports 30% of college students' academic performance was negatively affected by stress. More than 85% report feeling overwhelmed by deadlines to get things done. Wayne Carpenter is Director of Counseling Services at Western New England University.
So we can look at just the way children have been raised differently than perhaps a generation or two ago. There's a lot more high stakes pressures on students with high stakes testing. I think if you look at childhood itself, it's more organized than I think it used to be a few generations ago. So you've got, you're on the little soccer teams, you're on the baseball teams, you're on the football teams, the hockey teams. Then you get to a certain level where, it may seem important to be on the elite teams, on the travel teams, the different club teams, because I think parents look at that and say, if you go to this level, that's going to get you to the next level further down the road.
Childhood experiences are only one element associated with college stress. Factors such as overstimulation and increased information processing are connected to an increased use of social media. Irregular sleep patterns and unorganized schedules also spark stress.
So I think all of this, when you put it all together, I think it's a much more pressured environment for students. The other factors are probably social, political, or even geopolitical. I mean, this generation now is coming up under the umbrella of 9/11, of terrorist attacks around the world. There's a certain element of fear, perhaps, underlying that I'm sure doesn't go unnoticed at some level in kids as they're growing up. I think the economy has had families stressed with meeting financial obligations. Taken all together, there's this background kind of stress.
Framingham State University senior Morgan Moniz discusses her experience with stress.
College is an extremely stressful time, from working hard to get good grades, finding the perfect internship to boost your resume, and trying to figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life, all while trying to find yourself at the same time. While it is only natural to stress about that 25-page paper or that huge interview you have next week, I've learned that in the end of the day, everything will work out. So just work hard, but don't forget to live, because at the end of the day, the stress isn't worth it.
Coping with and managing stress are often individualized, but Carpenter says there are a few proven tricks.
Meditation, exercise, we know that exercise, in fact, this is demonstrated in the research, exercise in and of itself is a wonderful stress reliever, and can help can manage it better. Taking time for yourself, putting the phone away, shutting down the computer, taking a walk in the woods, getting back into nature is very restorative. There's something very deep within us that connects with nature.
The Center for Collegiate Mental Health reports stress trends continue to increase for college students. In a two-year time span, the number of college students hospitalized for mental health concerns has grown nearly 3%, and the number of students contemplating suicide rose 5% in 2 years. To help, more colleges are offering additional services to help their students deal with feeling overwhelmed and underprepared when it comes to balancing time with an ever-increasing to-do list. Reporting from Western New England University, I'm Sophie Cannon.
as we've heard, the time demands for young people starting college can be stressful. But for older adults, filling up some time with volunteer work can be beneficial. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is volunteering beneficial for everyone? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Stephen Puritinsky, assistant professor in the Graduate School of Social Work at Truro College, examines how some, but not all, older adults benefit from helping others.
Studies associate volunteering with improved mood, leading some to recommend volunteering to older adults who might be otherwise isolated. But the research has a few problems. It's hard to determine whether the mood boost comes from the pro-social aspect of volunteering, from helping others, or from the social contact that these activities typically provide. Secondly, we don't know whether people who are generally happier tend to volunteer, or whether volunteering contributes to being happier. The research has shown correlation, not causation. Third, we hypothesized that volunteering helps some people, but not others, based on individual characteristics. In our study, we split older adults into three groups. One group imagined a pro-social activity, one group imagined a purely social activity, and the control group imagined a neutral activity. We found that only those who scored high on social responsibility, a measure of how much they valued responsibility towards others, experienced more positive affect in the pro-social condition compared to the social or neutral conditions. In fact, those who scored low on altruistic orientation, a measure of how connected you feel towards others, reported greater negative emotion when imagining a pro-social behavior compared to those who scored high on altruistic orientation. This study provides evidence that the benefits of volunteering are not just due to being around others, but that the act of helping may enhance mood. The other takeaway is that the benefit of pro-social behavior is connected to your value system and personality. If you don't value helping others or feel particularly connected to them, volunteering is not going to make you happier, and it may make you feel worse. People need to discover their own values and personality and choose activities that reflect these things to improve their mood.
That was Stephen Puritinsky of Truro College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.